Welcome to the FDD Events Podcast. I'm Cliff Mate, founder and president of FDD, and pleased to share with you the following conversation. Please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast so you don't miss out on future FDD events.
Good morning. It's Monday, March 18th. The war in the Middle East is now 164 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. Hostage talks continue, but so does the talk about a large ground operation in Rafah. And that comes amidst a full-blown firefight at a hospital you may have heard about a few times on this program. That's right, Shifa Hospital is back in the news. We track all of these headlines and more here at the FDD Morning Brief, so keep tuning in. In a few minutes, we'll have Flor Hassan Nahum on this show. She is a woman who wears many hats. She is the deputy mayor of Jerusalem. She is Israel's envoy for innovation. She's heavily involved in normalization with the UAE, and she's been very active in the media speaking out for Israel since this war began. But before we hear from Flor, after 5 months of fighting, the war in the Middle East is at a crossroads. All around the region, I see an eerie relative quiet. The fighting in Gaza with Hamas pinned down in Rafah is less fierce right now. Iran-backed militias in Iraq and Syria have backed down since the U.S. responded to the killing of three U.S. service members in January. The Houthis haven't exactly stopped terrorizing the Red Sea, but they're making less mayhem. The only exception appears to be Hezbollah. The attacks continue, but even Iran's Lebanese proxy seems to be weighing its next move. This is all the result of a side deal the White House cut with Iran. We don't know much about it, but it looks like the president has bought quiet so he could focus on elections. But a pause in the action conflicts directly with Israel's war aims. The Israelis want to defeat Hamas completely, and the Israeli people will stand for nothing less. And then there's this. Leaving Iran's regional war machine intact guarantees another war in the future, a larger war at that. So congrats, Mr. President, for doing whatever you did to convince the Iranians and their proxies to hold fire. I hope it was above board. But still, a battle looms over what comes next. Will Biden enable Israel to defeat Hamas as he promised back in October? Or will he force Israel to settle for a partial victory for the sake of temporary quiet? This is some serious intrigue, folks. A pivotal moment in this war. We'll continue to watch carefully. Now for your headlines. Headline one, Israel's Maariv newspaper reported on Saturday that 7,605 suspects have been arrested in the West Bank since the war began. This is not a small number, and that number continues to grow. Just on Friday, the Duv Divan unit arrested 16 wanted men in the West Bank. This is the unit, by the way, that dresses up like local Arabs and is said to be the basis for the show Fauda. Among those arrested was a senior Islamic Jihad operative. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Ramadan is upon us, and there is real reason to be concerned about an outbreak of violence in the West Bank. I'm glad the IDF is arresting wanted men, but there is a fine line to walk here between enforcing security and provoking the population. So far, so good? It appears so. Headline two. Relatedly, Jordan's King Abdullah had a phone call last week with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, stressing the need to contain escalations during Ramadan. I've had my criticisms of the king. His rhetoric during this war has been reckless at times. His wife, Rania, the queen of Palestinian descent, her rhetoric has been beyond the pale. But this call to Abu Mazen strikes me as an important development. Keeping a lid on Ramadan escalation strikes me as one of the most important things that Jordan could do right now. By the way, Jordan is helping in other ways, too, between airdrops of aid and a field hospital in southern Gaza. I have a healthy respect for the ways that Amman is trying to support the Palestinian people. But keep an eye on Jordan's economy, folks. They have lost a lot of money in recent years, and now they've lost UNRWA funding amidst revelations that the disgraced UN agency was helping Hamas terrorist operations. This will place a burden on the kingdom, and it could hurt those other efforts that Jordan has mounted in recent months. And finally, headline three, the IDF destroyed a big chunk of a very large tunnel that was said to connect the northern and southern Gaza Strip. The tunnel measured 2.5 kilometers. That's a little more than 1.5 miles for us Americans who have no idea what the metric system is. But if you ask me, this looks like a move that the IDF has made in advance of an operation in Rafah. The last thing they want is Hamas migrating north, where the IDF has cleared out the majority of the Hamas fighters. But just so we're all clear, there are an estimated 500 miles of tunnels in Gaza. Some say this is equal to the London Underground and the New York subway combined. It's going to take a long time for the IDF engineers to destroy these tunnels. Some say it might take a year. Under this current circumstances, between President Joe Biden and now Donald Trump calling for a rapid end of the war, I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around how all those tunnels are going to be dismantled quickly. Okay, I'm now pleased to introduce Flor Hassan Nahum. She is the deputy mayor of Jerusalem. She's Israel's special envoy for innovation. She's the co-founder of the UAE Business Council, UAE Israel Business Council. She recently became the first woman to serve as Secretary General of the World Confederation of United Zionists. For all you Ted Lasso fans out there, she's like Roy Kent. She's here, she's there, she's everywhere. And we're thrilled she's joined us today on the FDD Morning Brief. Welcome, Flor.
Good morning, Jonathan. Good afternoon to us. Good morning to you. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for joining us. Let me start with this. What does it mean to be the deputy mayor of Jerusalem? And what does it mean to be the Israeli special envoy for innovation? Sounds like you're doing a lot these days. What is your role?
I am doing a lot, but to clear up, I've actually didn't run for the local elections 2 weeks ago. I will be deputy mayor until the end of the month. And then a new council is sworn in, and that completes my 8 years as a city council member and 5 years as a deputy mayor. And as a result of the fact that I knew that I wasn't going to run again, I was appointed special envoy for trade and innovation by the foreign ministry a few months ago, when we thought that the local election was going to happen end of October. Never, I don't think there's ever been a moment in Israeli history where the local election was actually postponed, but we were, and we still are, in the middle of this horrible war. So the election actually took place 2 weeks ago. But in all these months, I have been doing two roles. And I think, in fact, they're very complementary in many, many ways. But one day does not look like the next.
I can only imagine. Well, let me ask you, you're the co-founder of the UAE Israel Business Council. Tell us a little bit about what's going on that front. We hear obviously a lot about the rumors of Saudi Arabia. That's taking place very separately from the ongoing relationships that Israel has to nurture during a somewhat trying time here. So how are the Abraham Accords faring between Israel and the UAE?
Well, you know, Jonathan, through this whole terrible, traumatic period that we're going through, if there's one little thing that gives me a little bit of hope, it's actually the Abraham Accords, and I'll tell you why. First of all, when October the 7th happened, I think it was a shock to the system, to the entire region, but especially the countries that had made peace with Israel. These countries actually are very familiar with who Hamas are, because Hamas are part of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the UAE, in fact, kicked out the Muslim Brotherhood from their country about 10 years ago. Bahrain, during the Arab Spring, also had their confrontation with the Muslim Brotherhood, and we saw in that period, if you remember, Saudi tanks on the street to protect the king from being taken over by some Muslim Brotherhood coup. And of course, Saudi Arabia has spent the part of, even before 9/11, has spent decades trying to get rid of their version of the Muslim Brotherhood, who are the Wahhabis. So to put it in perspective, they know exactly who Hamas are, but they also know that the Palestinian cause plays very well on the Muslim street. So they can't come out and declare their loyalty or declare any type of support for Israel. But in the world that we live in and in the region we live in, let me tell you what support looks like. About a month after October 7th, the Arab League, which is comprised, I think, of 22 members, met in order to pass three boycotts. The first one was to boycott American military from having bases in the Gulf. And the other two were about Israel. One was to roll back the Abraham Accords, and the other one was another anti-Israel boycott. And they did not succeed in passing these boycotts. Now, in this world, in the Middle East, and in the Arab world, That's called progress, Jonathan. And so that's the first thing we have to think about. And as you see marches in your capitals, in Europe, around the world, let me tell you where you don't see any marches. You don't see any marches in Saudi Arabia. You don't see any marches in the UAE. And you don't see any marches in Bahrain. One small march in Morocco. And so what does this tell us? Basically, it tells us that the UAE and Saudi are very aware of who the enemy is. And our enemy is the Muslim Brotherhood. But they also know that the Muslim Brotherhood everywhere is facilitated, funded, and trained by Iran. And the main purpose of the Abraham Accords to these countries and of, please God, the joining of Saudi Arabia to the Abraham Accords is the fact that we all know that we all share an enemy, which is the Shia Iran regime, the Islamic Republic of regime, who have a few clear aims. One is, and for their purposes, what scares them is Shia homogeny of the region. The second is that these people are Islamic fundamentalists who are not going to stop with Israel. This is just the beginning for them. They're on their way to getting nuclear power. And they've declared a few times that they want to get rid of Israel as a country. But they are no less threat to Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, etc. And the reason why the Saudi peace initiative will go ahead, maybe not now in the middle of this terrible war, is because the Saudis are interested in one main thing. And that is a mutual defense pact with the United States. And they know that the price they have to pay in order to have a defense pact with the United States is peace with Israel. And for that reason, it will happen sooner or later. And that is why I'm actually positive or optimistic, you know, during these very difficult times.
Well, that is heartening. I will say that the concern that we see in some of these Arab states about the alliance between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood, I think it's real. I think the fear of enabling or allowing the Muslim Brotherhood to get involved in local politics, where, of course, the leadership likes to maintain a monopoly over those politics, I think it all begins to add up, where Israel is seen as much less of a threat than some of those other actors. Now, let me just shift gears for a minute and ask you about another threat. You were quoted in Politico the other day, noting that Israel was going to have a very rough Ramadan. Has it been rough so far?
Well, thank God. Well, let's split where it's been or hasn't been rough. So I'm always worried about Jerusalem, of course, because it is my constituency, but also because I've been long enough here in a leadership position to understand the Hamas playbook for Ramadan. And here is how it has gone every year for the last 5 years. We have 200 terrorists / hooligans. Some of them are not, you know, not even experienced enough to be terrorists, who go to pray on a Thursday evening, and they don't leave. They lock themselves into the mosque. They show up with big boulders like this and explosives. They lock themselves into the mosque. They desecrate the mosque. And then Israeli forces know that the following day, Friday, which is the big day for Ramadan prayers, we're going to have at least 100,000 peaceful Muslims. And so we have these people lock themselves up. At some point, they start opening the doors and throwing the big boulders over to the Wailing Wall. And then Israeli police go up to clear the area, to make the area available for the rest of the day for Muslim worshippers. And then the news comes out, the rhetoric comes out in the Arab world that Israeli police are storming Temple Mount. And as a result of that, Hamas throw a rocket and they start their short wars that we've seen so far until October 7th. This is what we've had the last 5 years, short 1 week, 2 week wars, whereas they throw rockets, we go in, we bomb. It ends up in a teko, as we say in Hebrew. It ends up in a draw. Yeah. And we go back to our lives, and we believed erroneously for many years, I'm no military expert, but for many years we believed that we could kind of pay protection money to Hamas to keep them quiet until next Ramadan, because that's always happened. I think a year and a half ago, it was the summer rather than Ramadan. But this is the playbook. It's curated. It's a curated conflict. Now, this year, it's different, because this year, we're already in a war. with Hamas. And of course, we've decapacitated many of their rocket launchers, even though they were still throwing rockets until last week. So they obviously still have capabilities. But what we can see is that there's still a call to all Muslims, and they're also appealing to Arab Israelis and Jerusalem Arabs, to come to Temple Mount and create a confrontation to stand for Al-Aqsa. They emotionally manipulate the Muslim world by telling them that the Jews are going to stop prayer on Temple Mount. And not only is that a cynical lie, it's defamation, because we're doing the very opposite, but we're also actively facilitating prayer on Temple Mount by making sure that it's safe, by facilitating buses from the different checkpoints coming in from the Judean Samaria checkpoints from the Palestinian Authority territory. We put buses every single year. And so I've learned this word in this war, and it's gaslighting. And this is what they do every single year, gaslighting.
I'm afraid you're right. I think this is part of the playbook, but at least so far, it seems that the Israeli authorities have kept a lid on conflagration.
So far, Jonathan, but it's normally, and I don't mean to be pessimistic, because every Friday I'm like, I've got my heart in my throat waiting to see what's going to happen. But it's normally the second Friday of Ramadan. They've kind of got themselves more organized. So I'm just praying that I'm wrong.
Interesting. Second Friday. Okay, yeah. We'll keep an eye on this coming Friday then. Just to broaden out for a minute, I mean, just a question about Jerusalem itself. I mean, I know you're concerned about Ramadan right now, but how have things been? I mean, this is a mixed city at the end of the day, right? Arabs and Jews living together, there's no way around it. And it's obviously been a tense time. How has the City of Gold, as we call it, how has the City of Gold held up?
Well, let me tell you, Jonathan, that for the last 10 years, and I'm very proud to be part of this evolution and revolution, there's been unprecedented investment and economic development that the city of Jerusalem has put into East Jerusalem. Because the conception changed about 10 years ago. We said, you can't say this is one united city and under-resourced part of the city, which had been for many years, and we have to look in the mirror about these things. But for about 10 years, there's been a change. And we've created a lot of wonderful relationships with local leadership, the local chiefs of the different neighborhoods. We've created planning policy in consensus with them. We've built parks and schools. We've cleaned up East Jerusalem. A sidewalk in East Jerusalem should look like a sidewalk in West Jerusalem. And I'm very proud to be part of an administration with the mayor who thankfully won again last week, that has really dedicated so much of our time and resources. My beat has been economic development, we've done a lot, not just in general. We've opened up high-tech spaces. We're developing a high-tech park. But I've been doing a lot also with Arab women in East Jerusalem, empowerment and great jobs in high-tech and intensive learning programs so that they can get to the best places in university. So we really have come a long way with East Jerusalem. And I'm hoping that I'm not being delusional or too optimistic when I say that I think these ties that we've built are holding on through the toughest of tests.
This is good news indeed. I am going to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the FTD Morning Brief. Thank you, Flor Hassan Nahum.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Okay, here's what FTD has on tap for you today. My colleagues David Adesnik and Mark Montgomery have a new essay and commentary debunking the alleged Israeli crime of dropping 2,000-pound bombs on Hamas targets in Gaza. My colleagues explain the actual capabilities of these bombs, which are legitimate weapons to deploy, and why Israel is using them despite media criticism. We've got an all-star podcast for you to hear featuring FTD CEO Mark Dubowitz and FTD Senior International Fellow Eyal Hulata, as well as FTD's President Cliff May. That's a lot of intellectual heft for one episode of FTD's Foreign Policy, and that episode explores how the Supreme Leader of Iran is setting the region on fire through the Islamic Republic's proxy strategy. but they also look at how this might be a distraction for the regime to make a dash for a nuclear weapon. Scary stuff, well worth a listen. From FDD's Center on Economic and Financial Power, Elaine Dazensky and Josh Birnbaum have a new piece in The Hill offering specific ways America and our allies can leverage what they call radical transparency to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. This is the way to counter Beijing's corruption, surveillance, and secrecy that form the backbone of China's global domination strategy. And finally, FDD adjunct fellow Tony Bowman is out with a new piece in Real Clear Education on the anonymous social messaging apps used on college campuses throughout America. These apps have turbocharged anti-Semitism online and on campus. She calls on college administrators to intervene. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, fdd.org. Read our quick takes on X at FDD and support our work with a tax-deductible donation at fdd.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for what promises to be an exciting episode of the FDD Morning Brief. We'll be speaking to Congressman Richie Torres. I am thrilled to speak with him. Have a great Monday, folks. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FDD.